The two daughters, one is driven to near insanity and becomes a harlot, an harlot, a Coleman woman. The other, the one they want, will not fall to them. She seeks out a holy man whose name is Blaise, or Blasius. Interestingly enough, it's also the name of a saint whose holy day is just in a couple of days. He was a Christian saint associated with diseases of the throat. And on the 3rd of February, we say a blessing with candles held across the throat, a sidelight. Blaise was his name. And the holy man counseled her. He said to her, you know, if you can simply avoid wrath, anger, if you can do that, if you can keep your mind holy and pure and avoid anger, they will have no entry to you. Well, the demons understand the problem. They decide what they've got to do is get her angry. And they develop a plot, and she is attacked by her sister who has become a harlote, a Coleman woman, and the band of other harlots. She is in such anger and disturbance, she goes in her room. She locks the door, and she's angry. And she falls asleep angry. And in her sleep, the demon comes. And she awakens in the morning to find herself no longer a maiden, but a maid. And she finds herself with child. She goes to Blaise, the old priest, and he tells her what she should do. He tells her of penances and ways to try to undo the work. The people of the town see that she's pregnant. And they accuse her. Who's the man? They ask. And she says, I have known no man. And this is the interesting part of the story, because this comes up repeatedly. She's in the story, she's repeatedly accused. Who's the father of this child? And she keeps saying, I know not. I have known no man. And what does everyone say? Well, that's impossible. Who in history has ever heard of a woman conceiving without a man? They say this a dozen times. Different folks. Well, who in the world's ever heard of such a thing? Now, that couldn't happen. You sort of have to wonder, perhaps, at the intent of the author. They say it so darn many times, it must come to mind that at least there was one. Well, the child is born, and part of the plot to defeat the demons is to have it baptized immediately after birth, and this is done. The story goes on in many ways. The child saves his mother's life at her trial. She was going to be burned. He accuses the judge and says to the judge, this baby speaking, that this woman knows his father better than you do. The judge, of course, thinks that this could not be so. He calls his mother to evidence. His mother denies it all, but then it comes out in truth that his mother actually had had an affair with the parson. And the young babe, Merlin, was a bit right. This lady, his mother, knew more about her father than did he. The child grows of lineage, dark and light, of a lineage of a mortal woman, a virgin, pure and holy, and of a demon, but somehow saved from the demonhood. He's given to Blaise, the noble monk, to be a ward. And Merlin actually uses Blaise as his scribe to write the history that will be his history. The story it tells about, it's a long story, obviously. And I could go on and on and on about that story, but I won't. I'll just tell you two other chapters, important. Early in his childhood, there is a king by the name of Vortigern, who's trying to build a tower. It ends up Vortigern is a ruler, a British ruler, and he ends up being really a bit of a bastard. He's a nasty fellow. People thought he was going to be a good guy, but he ends up being king and really a really nasty tyrant. And he's building or trying to build a tower, a strong tower in the hills. But every time the foundation gets up and the walls start to be formed, the earth shakes and they fall down. And so Vortigern goes to his counselors and asks them, what should we do? And they tell him, well, what we need to do is find a child without father. And then we need to kill him and sprinkle his blood around a bit, and that'll take care of things. So, interesting. A child without earthly father, we sacrifice him, and his blood, well, that takes care of the problem. We've heard that story before, too. But a reflection, you see. The Merlin myth, a reflection. Well, Merlin comes. He avoids being sacrificed. He confronts the king and tells him that I will disclose to you what the problem is, if you wish. And he tells him the story. The problem, you see, is that this noble tower the king is trying to build has foundation laid upon a ground under which struggle two dragons, a red dragon and a white dragon. And every time they feel the weight of the castle building on their backs, they start shrugging and struggling, and then the castle falls down. So Merlin says, if you want to take care of this, what you need to do is drain the lake underneath here. Find the dragons. The dragons will then themselves fight. And Merlin says, I will not read here. Merlin tells him that that in their battle, in the battle of the red and the white dragon, there is great significance. A conflict of opposites. An attempt to build a structure on unstable ground, made unstable by the lack of realization that underneath, in the waters, there are struggling two forces, red and white, light and dark. Merlin becomes the prophet in the Arthurian legends of the Grail. Prophet. Vine. Vis. Seer. Seer. Visit. Seer of the Grail. And this is a role we frequently find of the wizard, particularly this archetypal, this first wizard of the West. He is a helper in the quest to find this most magical and transformative object. Now, he cannot rule how the quest will end, but he can aid on the journey with his vision. And then there's the ending of Merlin. It involves a maid, a maiden, by the name of Nimiane, or Nineveh. In some recensions of the myth, Nineveh, or Nimiane, is seen sort of as a witch, as an evil force, but she's not that at all in the story, as once told. Merlin, in his journeys, comes to a well, and he meets there a young girl, perhaps 12 years of age, and he is entranced by her. He falls actually in love with her. And to amuse her, perhaps impress her a bit, I mean, he's a wizard, why not? He calls forth a tower. He says, let me show you something, missy. And so he goes over, and with his staff, he makes a circle on the earth three times and does his calls, and there a great tower grows. And then from the forest there come squires and damsels singing and dancing. And they come, and they make quite a racket of amusements, a big party, which they say can be heard for miles away. And, of course, the young girl is, well, duly impressed. And, in fact, so impressed that what she says is, quoth she, teach me so to do. Learn me so to do. Hey, that's a neat trick. You know what? I'd like to learn how to do that myself. And Merlin decides that he will teach her. Quoth Merlin, be then a clerk? He asks her, are you a clerk? Are you a scholar? Do you understand how to read and write? Well, yes, she is. She's an intelligent woman. She reads. She writes. She quests after understanding. She is also, we should add, the daughter of a king, a noble woman. Well, the story goes on, and over many years, Marilyn teaches her. He falls in love with her. Their love becomes full in every sense. And she learns his arts. But there's one thing that she wants more to know. She wants to know how to make a tower, like he did to start.
Then departed Merlin, and in little space come to his love, that great joy of him made and he of her, and dwelt together long time. And ever she inquired of his crafts, and he her taught and learned so much, that after he was holden a fool, and yet is. They thought he was a fool for teaching her. It was his own downfall. And she them well understood, and put them in writing, as she that was well expert in the seven arts.
She was an expert in the seven arts, a learned woman.
And when he had her taught all that she could ask, she bethought her how she might him withhold forever.
She wanted to bind herself, in a sense, to Merlin.
Sir, yet can I not one thing that I would fain learn, and therefore I pray you that ye would me inform. And Merlin, that well knew her intent, said, Madam, what thing is that? Sir, quoth she, I would fain learn how I might one sut in a tower, without in walls or without in any closure, by enchantment, so that he should go out withouten my license. That he should ne'er go out withouten my license.
She asks him, how do I build a tower that I can imprison somebody in, within walls, so that he can't leave? Marilyn knows exactly what's going on, but he teaches her. And so one day they go out into the forest, deep into the forest. They find a hawthorn bush in flower and lay themselves down. Marilyn rests his head in her lap and falls asleep. Gently she arises.
And when she felt that he was on sleep, she arose softly and made a cairn, in your tongue, a circle, a cairn. With her wimple, scarf, you say, with her wimple, and all about the bush, and all about Merlin, and began her enchantments, such as Merlin had her taught. And she made the sair 9 times, and 9 times her enchantments, and held him there till he did awake. And when he looked about him, and him seemed, he was in the fairest tower of the world, and the most strong, and found him laid in the fairest place that ever he lay before him.
So Merlin was there in the tower, laying with his love. And so it was forever. He was encaptured. She could go out. She who he had taught, she could come back. He there rested. And it is said that in the deep ancient forests, one can yet to this day hear the cry of Merlin from that tower, the wizard, the archetypal wizard. Well, I could say more about that particular story of his capture, the young woman. You know, these are imaginational creations. They are not allegories. They weren't meant to image some external reality point for point as a morally instructive story. They're primary creations of the imagination, like dreams, medieval dreams. And perhaps those dreams have meaning. Perhaps even they have prophetic intent. Perhaps the young woman is a bit like the Western soul itself, arising from the mists of medieval time, trained by a vision, a wizard in the arts of creation. The wizard himself, the one with primary vision, he, in the process, is locked in a tower and forgotten. Locked in a tower by Western consciousness, locked in a tower to which we have in many ways lost the keys, because we know as modern folk there are no wizards. We know. We know we have our those skilled in the seven arts, don't we, huh? We've got a few seven archers around here. Folks that know all the philosophy and all the science and all the math, but have forgotten. Forgotten. Weit this vision and wizards. Well, our own modern imagination, of course, has seen the wizard again find place in the modern psyche. Not that Maryland has ever been very distant from us over these last 1,000 years. He has danced in the psyche of the West in many ways, found many roles. But along comes a modern magician of sorts, a modern bard in the old tradition, by the name of John Ronald Reuel Tolkien. And Tolkien was indeed a visionary, a master of the imagination in the same sense as were those old medieval bards, which I might add, he made his own life's study. The man was a philologist, a linguist. And what was his specialty? The legends of Middle English. He knew these folks well. And as he tells us in his great essay on Beowulf, he felt a deep affinity with the bardic soul of that distant time. The bards, remember, were also the druids. They were the old legend tellers, the ones with imaginative vision. The visions that constellated into what we know as the Lord of the Rings began when Tolkien was perhaps an adolescent. He went to the Cornish coast, I think he was about 14, and a poem came to him. It was about one Elendil, who sailed across the western seas after a star. He wrote the poem down and he gave it to a dear friend. The friend read it. Said, well, you know, that's interesting. But what's it about? It's essentially a vision fragment of a sailor, Elendil, and a star, and a voyage. That's it. What's it about? And the young Tolkien scratched his head and said, I don't know. I will have to find out. I will have to find out. You see, and that's the difference between Tolkien and Tolkien's experience of the imagination and what some of us consider to be the creative process. If we were to say, well, what's it about? Many of us might think, well, I'll have to figure something out. I'll have to make something up. I'll make something up to go with this. But Tolkien's approach to the unconscious, to the imaginative realm, was one of discovery. I will have to find out. I will have to go on an adventure into, a quest into, that creative realm. The dear friend to whom Tolkien had given the poem went with him into the Great War, to the Battle of the Somme, and there died as did one of Tolkien's other dear friends, with him, part of the Yorkshire Fusiliers in around 1916. In the great carnage of that war, he went over the top into the machine guns of the German forces, into the barbed wire. But the night before he died, he wrote Tolkien a letter, a short note, saying, indeed, as perhaps only a soldier on the eve of a great battle can say, can know, that he would not return. And he commissioned Tolkien that if indeed he should die, that Tolkien should continue and bring to fact the dreams that they all once shared. Tolkien did not die, of course, in the trenches, but he sickened gravely. He started suffering from high fevers. They couldn't figure out the cause. They sent him back to hospitals in England. And thankfully, the mysterious fevers continued day after day, and he sat in bed for about 8 months, and he never was sent back to the front. They never figured out why, but every time it would be about ready to discharge him from the hospital and send him back to that battle, his fevers would spike. And in that period, he began to discover languages, tongues, words, exhalations of divine breath, from a realm that he could not quite identify with anything in this world. They came from a land that in later years he called Faerie. They came from the land of Faerie, and the voices, the words, were elfin voices. The tongue was an elfin tongue. He began actually to investigate the language first, and in his investigation of the language that he was hearing from his creative imagination, he became interested in the events. He says, really, you know, I wasn't setting out to write these stories. I was just trying to figure out who was speaking this language. In the course of 20 years, this is from the late 1916-18 period up through the early 1930s, Tolkien developed two or three full-formed languages. At the same time, of course, he was a professor and ultimately a don at Oxford, teaching about Middle English and Beowulf and the ancient legends of the bards. But he was creating his own language. And from that quest of understanding, from that attempt to find out, came a, how could I describe it? An unformed volcanic eruption of creative magma. Myths, one after the other. They are very briefly summarized, redacted into a book called The Silmarillion now, put together by his son. But the myths themselves were something he never could get a handle on. He tried, actually, after The Lord of the Rings was published in 1953 or so, for the rest of his life, 20 years, to put a form upon what had happened to him, what he had seen, what he had written in those years between 1918-19 and the mid-1930s. And he simply could not do it. They existed rather like the Grail myths themselves. Many different visions, many names, many events. And they just simply could not be brought into one corpus, though he might try. At his death, he had literally a garage full of manuscripts of his attempts to write and rewrite and form and combine and somehow make sense of this material. Thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. And his son Christopher, from those, put together a small, small fragment of it into a book called The Silmarillion now. And so when The Lord of the Rings comes, you have to understand that this great work and its wizard are born not freshly to the imagination, but they emanate, shall we say, organically from a 20-year experience of creative imagination, of myth, primary vision, bardic vision. And chief among those figures of that creative imagination is one old fellow we know as Gandalf. Gandalf his name, and so also his name, Grey Wanderer, Greyheim, Mithandrir, Olorin, because in many languages he had many names. In Tolkien's emanational creation myth, there were a variety of outflowings of the first creative force, known as Iluvatar. From Iluvatar there came the Valar, the first gods. And from these gods there came helper spirits, which were known as the Maiar. And in the 1,000th year of the Third Age of Middle-earth, there arrived at the Grey Havens 5 wizards. The elves knew them as Istari, in the elven tongue. Istari, Vai, Ai, Is, Istare. Well, perhaps there's an elvic etymology there. The wise ones was what Istari meant, these 5 wizards. They were apparently a representation of the Maiar, the spirits, come to mortal form. But they were clearly mortal. They had human emotions. They had great power, but they also had limitations. And they had come to stand in a battle of light and dark. The lineage of the Maiar was also represented in Middle-earth. This spiritual, shall we say, lineage was also represented in Middle-earth by the Dark Lord himself. Sauron himself was a Maiar. You see, the spirit that was in, intrinsically, the root of Gandalf, the wizard, was the same spirit force in the evil. It was the same spirit force in the good. The fact that there is this unseen force present in Gandalf did not make him good or bad. It was a power which could be good, which could be bad, which could be light, which could be dark. And the wizard walked that razor course between the two, trying to stay in balance. A complexio oppositor, a complex of opposites, dualities. The wizard walked that road with both natures, consciously present. And of course, this Gandalf, this Grey Wanderer, became a guide. Vibe, guide, guide to the Middle Earth. Like Merlin, he was a prophet of a quest. Oh, the quest existed, perhaps before him. The quest perhaps always existed. From the very foundation, it existed. But he was here to announce it, to help on the journey. Gandalf was mortal and apparently immortal. The signal image I have of Gandalf, and I think many of us have, comes at the bridge of Caradhum, where the Balrog comes up out of the darkness. That Balrog, that force of darkness, that too is a child, a manifestation of the Maiar, the primal spiritual force. And there, Gandalf encounters him. Look ahead, called Gandalf. The bridge is near. It is dangerous and narrow. Aye, aye, wailed Legolas. A Balrog has come. A Balrog, muttered Gandalf. Now I understand. He faltered and leaned heavily on his staff. What an evil fortune. I am already weary. The dark figure streamed with fire and raced towards them. The orc yelled and poured over the stone gangway. Then Boromir raised his horn and blew. Loud the challenge rang and bellowed, like the shout of many throats under the cavernous roof. For a moment the orcs quailed, and the fiery shadow halted. Then the echoes died as suddenly as a flame blown out by a dark wind, and the enemy advanced again. "You cannot pass," said Gandalf. The orcs stood still, and a dead silence fell. "I am a servant of the secret fire, wielder of the sword of Anor. You cannot pass. The dark fire will not avail you. Flame of Udun, go back to the shadows. You cannot pass." Light and dark in confrontation. The Balrog is struck and severed by the sword of Gandalf. But in its fall back into the darkness, it enwraps his leg in a strand of its whip and pulls him into the darkness with it. This wizard, it seems, this gray one, must descend to the very depths of darkness, the very depths of the duality from which he himself was formed, before he can return as Gandalf the White and aid ultimately in the battle that will end the third age of Middle-earth. And so let me summarize. The wizard archetype. Two old and new, and perhaps timeless legends of the wizard. What he is in our imagination is perhaps summarized in the name by which we call him. Again, Vide Vision. Vizard. Wisdom. Vizard, guide. Vizard, seer. Vision, wisdom, seer, guide. His nature is a mix, it's a complexio oppositor. He's born of forces, light and dark, forces immortal and mortal. He has within him the potential of good and evil. He lives in time and beyond time. He announces or brings into focus a quest, a task of supreme importance. It involves an object of great potential and great power. A cup, a grail, a ring. He comes a guide to mortals in their quest. He cannot command the success of that quest. He is neither its beginning nor its end, but a gray wayfarer met by men in need and women in need in a dark forest on a very difficult path. The word become image in the legend of our people. The question we ask is, well, does this word become flesh? Can any human touch this archetype? Of course, in a sense, no. None of us carry magic wands. Well, if any of you do, would you? Oh, okay. Well, let me talk with you later, please. Anyway, though we would wish to. Oh, Lord, would we wish to. When the Balrogs come up out of our own depth, would not any one of us wish to have that staff and that sword? And then again, maybe in a different sense we do, if only we knew. And maybe indeed, the purpose of the wizard is not to make fireworks for the entertainment of the Shire. Spectacular special effects. Perhaps he comes. Perhaps he comes as a guide. Wise. Wisdom. And vision. To show us a way through the forest. Perhaps we might meet him on a ferry, unexpectedly, crossing a great and deep water, standing at its prow, wind in his hair, his eyes fixed upon unfathomable depths. Perhaps. And so I invite you to come with me over a few more weeks as we attempt to draw a portrait of a 20th century wizard, a man we know as Carl Gustav Jung. Thank you. And so, dear friends, we will get together again next Tuesday. And I will try to be a little more focused this time upon the man underneath the archetype. And we'll continue each of the next Tuesdays throughout February. And you're welcome to come and bring many, many other friends, hobbits, elves, dwarves, whoever they be welcome. Good night.